You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Digging Up Ancient Aliens. This is the podcast where we examine strange claims about alternative history and ancient aliens in popular media. Do their claims hold water to an archaeologist, or are there better explanations out there? We are now on episode 60. I am Frederick, your guide into the world of pseudo-archaeology. And we are going to continue the investigation on the Turin Shroud. And this is the second part of this investigation. And in this case, I would actually recommend you to go back and listen to the first part before listening to this one. Last time we looked at the history of the Shroud of Turin, and today we will look at the scientific side of the fabric. And before I start, I want to thank all of those who support the show through Patreon and the members portal. Your contribution helped to make this show better and provide good information to, well, your fellow people out there in the world. And if you also want to help, stay to the end of this episode and I will tell you exactly where you should go. Remember that you find sources, resources, and reading suggestions on the website, diggingupancientaliens.com. There you can also find contact info if you notice any mistakes or have any suggestions. And if you like the podcast, I really appreciate it if you left one of those fancy 5-star reviews that I heard so much about. Now that we have finished our preparation, let's dig into the episode. So, in the previous episode, we looked at the history of the Shroud, the early history, from its sudden appearance in France to its early hoax accusations, its near destruction, and how it ended up in Turin. We also looked at the other Shrouds. There's plenty of them all across Europe. While a good case can be made based solely on the history of the Shroud of Turin, could there be any scientific evidence that could help us authenticate or prove the Shroud to be a more, well, modern creation than the first century? And according to John DeSalvo, there is evidence that suggests that this is not a medieval creation.
The Shroud has been studied actually by some of the top scientists and researchers in the world. And with all the scientific knowledge and equipment, we still do not know how the image of the Shroud was produced.
Right. Usually, if you encounter stories about the cloth in the media, it's due to some proclaimed new scientific evidence. So let's pretend that the Charnay got the fabric in the Holy Land and smuggled it back to France. What is the scientific evidence and does it really hold up? Before we get into all of that, I will ask a very, very relevant question that we maybe should have started with before even talking about the history of the Turin Shroud. Would we expect to find a burial linen like this in a first century Jewish burial? Remember, Jesus was Jewish and due to this would have been buried according to Jewish customs. And because by Ian Huddle, we will cram some archaeology into this episode. So what would a typical Second Temple burial look like? To be as precise as possible, we will hone in to the period ranging from 100 BCE to about 100 CE. As usual, the answer will, of course, depend on whether you are rich or poor, like everything else in life. Part of our evidence of the burial practice come from historical sources like the rabbinical records and Josephus' writings. However, we also have archaeological records from Jerusalem and even more from Jericho's salvage excavations. So archaeologists have excavated Koch tombs in the necropolis of Jericho. And now Koch tombs are a type of burial complex with a narrow shaft sprawling out from a center chamber, so to say. And according to Hutch Lilly and Killebrew, within Jericho, we often find this central room that has a lowered floor and narrow locally tombs on each side of the three walls that's opposite of the entrance. And these are family tombs and were used by several generations. And this type of tomb are widespread in the Semitic world, and we can find them in places where we find Jewish colonies. And while these tombs are not known to have been decorated or painted, Hutch Lilly and Killebrew have found evidence of at least one of these tombs in the complex in Jericho that was decorated with paintings of wines, dating that tomb to the first century CE. Now, for a primary burial, we see that the deceased were carried inside the tomb inside their coffins. And when placed in the coffins, the caretaker seemed to have put much effort into straightening the person's limbs. They all lay on their backs with their hands to the side of the body, and often the head is also tilted a little bit to the side. The coffins were made out of wood and held together by wooden plugs. Metal seems to have been used chiefly for decorations on the coffins. Inside, we have examples of the deceased being placed upon a sort of stick-filled leather mattress, and the question is why? There is a possible explanation that is the person likely died at home on their mattress, and instead of burning it, due to it becoming unclean, it was placed with the body inside the burial. And I hear you. You want to know if we have examples of imprints of woven material. And Bar Adon mentions, for example, a bulrush impression in a tomb in N.L. Geweyer, just on the side of the Red Sea. And if we read the Talmud, we get hints of reed mats being used in burials for the poor, at least. However, in John 11:44 and Kilaim 9:4, it indicates that also cloth were used in the burial. The material is not really specified. It could, as accounts like Bar Adon, Hutch Lilly, and Killebrew suggest, be the case that they used prayer shawls with fringes cut or even woven shrouds within the burials. So there are some evidence that textiles were used in Jewish burials during the first century CE. So it seems as textiles could have been used in early burials of Jewish people in Palestine, Israel. Now, the next question would then be, would a crucified person have been allowed to be buried according to Jewish customs? And that's a great question and quite important for our investigation here. The first thing we might have to settle is that Jesus would not have been executed by the Jews. He was executed by the Romans. While he, well, in part, was convicted by the Council of Sanhedrin, it was ultimately the Romans and Pontius Pilate who convicted Jesus of crimes against the state. And this is something we should have in mind when we proceed with our investigation here. So if we read the Bible, it said that Joseph of Arimathea took care of Jesus' body and arranged for his burial. But as Bart Ehrman points out, this narrative has a couple of issues. In the earliest account of this story that we find in Mark, we learn that Joseph of Arimathea is a respected council member. Now, this is the same council of Sanhedrin that, you know, all previously agreed to find evidence that would result in the death of Jesus. And Mark is unmistakable in that all council members agreed to this plan. They all wanted Jesus to be put to death. Isn't it a little bit strange that Joseph of Arimathea would suddenly have a change of heart in all of this? It could be explained by later gospel tradition that would try to find some heroes among well, the villains, so to say. Mark seemed to build on an even earlier account that we can find remains of in Acts 13:28-29. What's interesting with this verse is that it says that the council took him down from the tree or cross and arranged together Jesus' funeral. But Mark seemed to have changed this at a later point to be a single named councilman. And later Gospels would change this story even more and change Joseph into a up-to-then anonymous follower of Jesus. If we look at the other accounts like the Corinthians, Paul seemed to be very unaware of the name of the person who buried Jesus. But for the sake of argument, let's assume Joseph of Arimathea was a wealthy follower of Jesus. Would Pilate have allowed Joseph to take Jesus' body for a proper burial? The sources agree that the answer would have been no. Some apologists claim that Jesus had to be taken down due to the impending Sabbath according to the Jewish customs. But one might ask oneself, why would the Romans care to respect this tradition? The whole point of crucifixion was to humiliate and set an example. Remember, Jesus was not convicted for breaking Jewish law, but for creating a disorder in the Roman Empire. He was sentenced as an enemy of the state. And in the annals of Tacitus, we can read in Book 6, Chapter 29, that it was preferred to die by one's own hand than by execution. As Tacitus puts it, quote, "The fact that a man legally condemned forfeit his estate and was debarred from burial, while a criminal dying by suicide instead had his will and funerary respected." And this notion is supported by other authors and texts from this time, such as the criminal sitting on the cross was food for the scavengers, and a later point, the remains would be collected and put in a communal pit at the execution place. The whole point, again, of the crucifixion was to make a very vocal, humiliating, and violent point. People should look at this and think twice before becoming a rabble-rousing insurgent. So, would Pontius Pilate, with all of this in mind, allow Jesus a proper burial? Are accounts of him historically portray him as a rather stern ruler? He had people beaten up and killed for protesting and seemed to have cared little about Jewish customs or superstitions. So that he suddenly would honor the burial practice for someone from a very non-influential family, and on top of that, the burial of an enemy of the state, nonetheless, is rather strange. Some proponents of the narrative that Jesus was allowed a proper burial sometimes points to historical sources that we will get to within a moment here, but they might also mention a secondary burial found in Jerusalem. And a secondary burial in this context is that a couple of bones were found in an ossuary, and within this ossuary, which could also be described as a box of bones, archaeologists found evidence of a crucified person. And we know this since the nail is actually still stuck in the heel bone of this individual. It most likely hit a knot in the wood, making it hard for the person taking this individual down to remove the nail from the body. And instead, the nail was just cut off and, remained lodged in the calcaneus of this person. So while to some extent it's true that people were taken down from the cross and buried, but it is misrepresenting the historical sources that we really have, because there is a issue here that most of these pro-shroud people don't really mention in this case. And if we look at the writing of Philo, who was a Jewish philosopher in Alexandria, he writes in his work Against Flaccus that, quote, rulers who conduct their government as they should and do not pretend to honor, but do really honor their benefactors, make a practice of not punishing any condemned person until those notable celebrations in honor of the birthday of the illustrious Augustan house are over. I've known cases when, on the eve of a holiday of this kind, people who have been crucified have been taken down and their bodies delivered to their kinsfolk, because it was thought well to give them burial and allow them the ordinary rite, for it was meant that the dead also should have the advantage of some kind treatment upon the birthday of the emperor, and also the sanctity of the festival should be maintained. So as we see in the quote, it was expected during some particular festivities that execution and punishment were postponed for the duration of it. As Philo says, this was during the emperor's birthday in particular. So the practice was only used in minimal capacity and does not really fit with the execution of Jesus. So taken to the extreme, as John Crossan wrote, Jesus would have been left on the cross for the scavengers and other animals to feast upon him. So from what we have gathered so far, a rock tomb would not be out of the question if you were a rich person. If you were poor, it would have been a different burial here. But a burial person would likely have been swept in some sort of cloth, it seems like. The issue is that many things would talk against Jesus being allowed down from the cross. Also, as Jody Magnus put it, nothing stopped Joseph of Arimathea from removing Jesus after the Sabbath to another tomb that would not contain Joseph's family members in it. Remember, these rock-hewn tombs would have been family tombs used for generations. But let's again say that Jesus was allowed down, swept in cloth. Is the Turin shroud really made from fabric of the correct period? And there's a few ways to find this out, and the first would actually be to look at the weaving of the fabric itself. But that will be after these few messages. Fellow archaeology lovers, science nerd, and history enthusiast, have you ever dreamt of showcasing your passion for our history and science? Dig no further. Welcome to the official merchandise store for your favorite podcast, Digging Up Ancient Aliens. Embark on a journey through time with our exclusive collection. Wrap yourself in the mysteries of the past with a range of themed shirts, mugs, and apparel. Each piece tells a story about your passions and podcast preference. And for the devoted archaeology aficionados, unveil our latest treasure, the Archaeology Mafia T-shirt. It is more than just apparel. It's a statement, a tribute to those who dig deeper, question the unknown, and unravel the secrets of our ancestors. These are not just merchandise. They are future relics from a time yet to be fully understood. Symbols of your dedication to unveiling the truth behind ancient aliens and the real wonders of our past. Join the crew of Digging Up Ancient Aliens, wear your curiosity, flaunt your knowledge, and join the Archaeology Mafia. Visit our store now and you will get an offer you can't refuse. Let's keep the spirit of exploration alive. Log on to diggingupancientaliens.com/store and grab your piece of history. Remember, the past is always present. Unfortunately, Jerusalem's climate is not great for preserving fabric. And this is due to the high humidity in the area, which means that we don't have a large selection of preserved textiles from this era. Luckily, we have actually a few that's been preserved to our day and can be used to compare against the Shroud of Turin. Something worth noting is that the largest fragment we have preserved is about 16 by 12 centimeters. Compare this to the 4.4 meter long shroud preserved in full that we find in Turin. So what do we know about fabrics that we have found from the Second Temple period? First of all, many of these fabrics seem to be, unbleached linen. then we have something that's often overlooked in this discussion, the spinning method. Now, I had no idea that there are two dominant methods of spinning yarn and thread, because I have had no reason to look it up until now. So we have a Z twist and a S twist. Great for speaking in podcasts with the Z and S sounds there, but the twist refers to the direction the fibers go and will. So if you hold up a thread or a string of yarn and the fibers seem to spiral upward in the same direction as the central part of an S, then we have a S twist. Basically, the fibers angle upward, leaning left to right. But if the fibers appear to spiral in the direction of the diagonal part of a Z, we have a Z twist, meaning the fibers angle upward from right to left instead. And in Israel and Palestine during the Second Temple period, all linen fabrics we have found are spun with a S twist. A few wool textiles have been found with a Z twist, but these seem to be important from either Rome or Greece. During this era, they actually spun with the Z twist. And the Z twist would not become standard in Israel or Palestine until after the Middle Ages. So let's look at the Torin shroud then. What method was used to create the thread? And the cloth used a Z spun thread with a 1/3 herringbone twill pattern. And as I mentioned before, all linen thread were spun with a S pattern in Palestine and Israel during this time, and they often used a plain weave tabby. Oret Shamir, a curator of organic materials for the Israel Antiquities Authority, points out that a herringbone twill was not found in textile in this part of the world until way after the Middle Ages. And she also pointed out that the thread count in the Torin shroud is about 38.6 threads per centimeter on the wrap or the diagonal threads. It is 25.7 at the weft or the horizontal thread. And this is a high thread count, especially when we compare this to the standard fabric in the region, with 10 to 15 threads per centimeter at the warp and 15 to 20 at the weft. So what does all of this mean for the shroud? As Orit Shamir puts it, pretty simply, the Torin shroud would not have been manufactured in Israel or Palestine, nor would it have been imported. So it indicates a medieval date for the creation of this piece of fabric. And everything in the creation of the cloth seemed to point toward a medieval date somewhere in Europe. Not everyone, however, agrees with this conclusion, and this is one of these cases where synonology shows exciting crossover with the alternative historians and ancient aliens. Like those promoting the ancient astronaut idea start their conclusion and work backwards towards it, so do synthologists. Giulio Fanti, an engineering professor, claims in his paper Why is the Torin shroud authentic? That the Z twist would indicate that this was for a high-ranking priest, this piece of cloth. Why this would be, or where he got this from, is not mentioned in his paper, nor is this backed up by other textile archaeology or history for that matter. While the Torah is quite precise in how things should be made, the twilling pattern isn't really mentioned in there. All I can find is Exodus 28:39, where it's specified that the tunic should be in checker work of fine linen. It can also be translated to embroidered work of fine linen. Also in Exodus 28:3, these garments need to be created and produced exactly as the Bible says they should. They are intended to be created to fulfill the word of God, and therefore should be made by those within the faith. And this practice is still found among, for example, Orthodox Jews today, and the production of the tallit, as an example. Furthermore, the priest's cloth would not have been sewn, meaning the fabric would have been woven into the shape in one single piece. So you could not just go and pick up a piece of cloth at the market and, sew a set of priestly attire out of it and used it at the temple. Giulio Fanti also claimed that the cloth originates from India, basing the claim not on archaeological or textile evidence from the era. Instead, he used a paper on DNA found on the Turin Shroud published by Gianni Barchaccia et al. In 2015. And this paper tries to trace the origin of DNA found on the Shroud of Turin. The conclusion, though, is a little bit lackluster, but as expected from being touched and handled by an unknown amount of people through centuries, while much of what they found originates in Europe and the Middle East, as expected, they also found traces from South America, America, and India. While the author acknowledged that the American contribution must be later contamination, it's not really discussed in any other sources there. The author also speculated that Indian DNA on the Turin Shrouds come from the one who created the cloth. Why? Well, they don't really specify how they came to this conclusion. It's just a method they use trying to explain how Indian DNA is present at the cloth, ignoring other sources of contamination. While, well, only 2% of modern India is Catholic, it still accounts for some 20 million people today. I mean, there's other ways that this DNA can be found on the Turin Shroud. I also have been unable to locate this trade mentioned by Giulio Fanti's paper. What I do find is later import described by, for example, Hillebrand in the 6th and 9th century in early Islamic era. There we have quite a lot of textile evidence recently discovered, actually, but again, these are much later fabric. Orit Shamir's statement that the import of this type of textile were not present around the 1st century CE still seems to hold up and seems to be the best explanation based on the available evidence we have. So while we discussing Huy's Second Temple burials and the Shroud of Turin, there are a claim that occasionally arises, and this is that supposedly there are coins depicted on the shroud. And these coins are claimed to have been minted during Pontius Pilate's reign. And this opens up a couple of questions for us. Would a Jewish person have been buried with coins during the 1st century CE? And can we really see these coins represented on the shroud? It was Jackson, Jumper, Moultern, and Stevenson who claimed that coins were visible where the eyes were on the figure on the shroud in 1977, based on a 3D picture they had created. And this was then elaborated on by Virginia Bortin in 1980, who claimed that coins over the eyes were a common practice among Jews. This claim is not really reflected in the understanding on the Second Temple burial practices either then, nor is it now. Hachili and Killebrew elaborated on the coins found in burials in their 1983 paper and basically states that coins are rare in general. However, there are a few examples where coins were placed in the deceased mouth. Two tombs in Jericho have been found with coins placed in this manner. As for coins being put over the eyes, only one example has been found. As Hachlili and Killebrew respond to William McCow, this is far from enough to claim that this was a widespread practice. Israel archaeologist Levi Ramani raises another question. Why would coins minted by Pontius Pilate be put over the eyes of someone who was put to death by Pontius Pilate and also a Jewish person? While there is one known case, the coin over the eyes would be a foreign practice and not really line up with the funeral practice mentioned in, for example, John 19:40. As for our second questions, Are the coins really visible? The answer is no. No, they are not. It's one of those cases where you start seeing patterns if you look at random noise long enough. Basically, it's a Rorschach's test, but with a claimed divine twist on it. And recent tests performed in 2011 and published by Salvatore Lorosso et al. Confirmed that no coins are visible based on modern image analysis. Then we have Fanti, a name that we will frequently encounter throughout this episode, with a different numismatic approach, of course. Instead of looking at potential coins represented on the Turin shrouds, he compared the artist's renditions of Jesus on coins to the image we see on the shroud. While a novel idea, he seems to cherry-pick a lot of data to get to the narrative that he feels fits with his preferred conclusion. Nothing really stops coins being spread through Europe. I mean, we have Byzantine coins with Jesus motifs, as he speaks about, being located in, I mean, the Norwegian mountains. There was a coin found quite recently, if I remember correctly, but different story. Coins spread fast and it spread far. As we know from Viking Age archaeology here in Scandinavia, coins are found plenty and they are not originating from Scandinavia. Is there anything else though we can look at to see when and how the cloth was created? Maybe a method that takes place in a lab setting? Well, luckily for us, there is. And our first method is a good old carbon 14 dating. Before we get into the tests themselves and the debate that's raged over them ever since, we should look at how the tests were made and by whom. Radiocarbon dating had been around since the 1940s, and while discussing regarding heavy shroud tests started quite early, the method available during that time would require a quite large piece to give a decent result. As the technology improved over time, the question regarding the Turin shroud's age come up again and again. And in 1970, the Roman Catholic Church started to put together a group of scientists who would be responsible for these tests. And in 1978, the Shroud of Turin Research Project, or STURP, were formed and had originally 33 members. While they all had a scientific background to some extent, none of them had any experience in archaeology, textile, art history, or history. They were all also religious. While this doesn't really make you a better or worse scientist per se, it does throw your neutrality into question when you're testing something that's claimed to be, well, the image of Jesus. I could imagine that you want that to be true. And it would be nice with some devil's advocates among this mix. The group then put together a testing protocol that was actually quite scientific. This was though stopped by the Catholic Church. The original protocol included blind tests and other examples of a relatively sound scientific approach. I have to give them that, but the final protocol went as this. Laboratories at Oxford, Zurich, and Tucson would perform the test. They would each receive one sample weighing 40 milligrams, sampled from a single portion of weave. The laboratories would each receive two control samples, clearly distinguishable from the shroud sample. Samples would be delivered to the laboratory's representatives in Turin. Each test would be filmed. There would be no comparison of result nor communication between laboratories until the results are certified as definitive, univocal, and complete. The proportional counter method would not be used because it required gram quantities rather than milligram quantities of the shroud material. The results were published in 1989 in Nature, giving a calibrated date of 1273 to 1288 CE with a 68% confidence, and a calibrated date of 1262 to 1312 CE and 1353 to 1384 CE with a 95% confidence. Giulio Fanti claims in a paper that these dates are widely contested, citing only his own papers, but sinologists have contested this result ever since for a variety of creative reasons. These range from the specific parts used was a medieval repair, it was contaminated by smoke from fire, bacteria, etc. You name it, basically. None has ever been able to show that that was really the case, but they are either highly unrealistic or based on data misused. And a recent approach to cast doubt on the C14 test is using, well, plain statistics. As one says, there's statistics and there's, damn lies. While Anders Christen published a paper in 1994 that showed that the tests were actually statistically accurate, other authors used a different approach. A 2020 paper by Brian Walls and Larry Schwalbe claims the test lacks statistical heterogeneity in the Turing-Shroud data. And these claims are not new, and as former editor of Nature Philip Ball puts it, this paper don't really show that the 1989 paper was inherently wrong. However, they show that the data itself is not conclusive. And here I can agree with Walls and Schwalbe, who suggest that more testing is needed. While this author wants to reuse the samples taken back in 1988, I would actually prefer that new samples were taken. This is to, well, silence claims of repairs or other fringe idea regarding the samples taken. I suspect if the existing samples are retested with a similar date, it will just lead us back to where we are right now and don't really add much more than a second round of tests on them. Alternative non-intrusive dating methods have been suggested by sinologists, such as, for example, vibrational spectroscopy. While this is a new and exciting way to date material in a non-destructive way, it still feels like it is a little bit maybe in its infancy. I also noticed some weird dates and calibration. Baraldi and Tini point out in a 2015 presentation that the Shroud of Turin with this method was dated to 300 BCE plus minus 400 years, and also 200 BCE plus minus 500 years. It's a very high uncertainty range for these tests, and while it's a promising method, the dates for the Turin Shroud still don't really fit a first century date, and other archaeological records we have of the type of fabric and what was used. And based on unspecified records, Fantini himself has since calibrated this date to a 400 CE with an uncertainty rate of 500 years. Other authors, while being optimistic, point out there's still lots of unknown with this dating method, so we should keep it with a grain of salt. It needs a little bit more time to gather more data and calibrate the testing, but the dates themselves as presented around the shroud, I mean, they aren't really there yet. But we still have a couple more, sources of evidence to look at, and we will get both to pollen found on the shroud and later replications of the Turin shroud after these few messages. Another approach to dating and authenticating the Turin shroud is pollen spores found on the cloth. Swiss criminologist Max Frey Sulzer claimed to have found 33 Middle Eastern pollen grains that would place the shroud in the first century Palestine. On top of this, Frey Sulzer also contended that the pollen was from Edessa in Turkey and the Anatolian steppe. Why Edessa is named specifically is due to sinologists' attempt to connect the Turin shroud with the shroud that was supposed to be located in the city of Edessa, also known as the Mandelion. According to sinologists, this would have solved the origin of the Turin Shroud. As we mentioned last time, the Turin Shroud just suddenly appeared one day in France, and no one connected to it could tell where it came from. This theory that the Turin Shroud is the Mandelilion has, though, been disproven by Andrea Nicolotti since. But let's return to the pollen samples. Micropaleontologist Stephen D. Schaffersman points out that it's a little bit unlikely that 33 pollen species will be found on the cloth and that they are specifically from Palestine, Turkey, and Anatolia. Schaffermann also points out that what's missing from the fabric is the most common species in the area. For example, no pollen from olive trees can be found on the shroud, but these trees are all over the region. It's unlikely that this type of pollen would not be on the shroud if it actually were in this region, and that the winds would select only specific pollen from different areas and collect them in a very small area on the shroud, as Schaffermann suggests, is more likely a case or indication of fraud or, well, some particular divine pollen intervention. Fry Sulzer is also one of those scientists who claim that the now infamous Hitler diaries were genuine. Walter McCrone would later show that the pollen samples were doubtful at best after Fry Sulzer died in 1993. Jo Nickel also point out that McCrone found that Fry Sulzer several times had been found guilty by the police in Switzerland of some, well, artistic interpretation of the criminal evidence that he had tested for them. And later samples seems to not be able to confirm the idea that the pollen was only from this region, as mentioned earlier with the DNA trace study done in 2015. But how was the Turin Shroud created then? In Ancient Aliens, we're told the following.
In 2011, Italian scientists were able to prove that the Shroud of Turin was created by a supernatural flash of light, an unearthly flash of light. In my opinion, the Shroud of Turin is proof that Jesus transformed himself into a being of light and projected himself through the Shroud of Turin.
And this quote refers to a study by Paolo Di Lazzaro et al. That claims that the image we see on the Turin Shroud was achieved through a flash of UV light. And the team behind the studies had not been able to produce a full body image on linen cloth yet, citing this being due to the limitation of the current technology. But like many other sindonologists, they claim that the image is, well, impossible to create from the start, hinting that the only solution can be divine intervention. This team also set up some strange limit on the criteria of what a replication must have and be to be viewed as a proper replication. For example, Di Lazzaro often claims that the coloration depth can't be deeper than 0.2 micrometer. And this measurement is based on the paint that come off when a few pieces of sticky tape were put on the textile. But Di Lazzaro doesn't adequately explain why the pigments found on this scotch tape would indicate the coloration depth on the textile. But this is used to rule out other recreation of the Turin Shroud that don't fit the preferred narrative of a divine creation. Because other replications have successfully been made. Jo Nickel, who we have mentioned before, replicated the image through, well, a basic relief method in the 1970s. Nickel even appeared in the show In Search Of to demonstrate how one could create a replica of the Shroud of Turin. And Nickel created a copy by wrapping a piece of wet cloth around a bas relief sculpture and then letting the cloth dry. He then applied pigments on the textile to achieve the darker and lighter portions, and others have used the same or similar method with some variation to create their own replicas on the shroud with good success rate. Other method includes a dust transfer technique, as Craig and Brassier did in 1994. Luigi Garacelli replicated the image in 2009 using medieval method and ACID. And this study was later criticized by, again, Fanti and, of course, De Lazzaro, with their own set limit of 0.2 micrometers as the main criticism. Now, all of these three methods show that replicating the image isn't as tricky as the pro shroud suggests that it really is. These methods also answer something the syndonologist failed to answer, a question I have as someone with long hair. Why is the hair hanging down straight in the shroud? This would not be the case if it was a real natural person. It would be the case if it was a statue the image was based on. I mean, I have long hair and I can't really say that my hair is straight down over my shoulders when I lay on my back. Well, I mean, it makes sense it would be a statue. I also wonder why on one hand the syndonologist claimed that the image can't be created by color pigments, while on the other hand admitting that there are pigments throughout the cloth. They even based the coloration depth on pigments they found on the cloth. Also worth mentioning here is the supposed blood on the fabric have so far all failed forensic serological tests. So, where does this leave us? If you look at these points separately, they don't really deny or confirm the Turin shroud. If you look at each sample individually, we could still create ourselves a mystery. But if we look at everything together as one should, the evidence for the shroud being a medieval hoax is somewhat overwhelming here. We can't really look at the evidence in a vacuum. We need to put everything together and look at it with critical eyes, something both syndonology and ancient aliens together seem to struggle with. And would it be good with more testing, more samples, more C14 samples? Sure. Would it really change something? Probably not, but if that is what it would require to settle this dispute, well, I, for one, welcome it, but with the church position currently regarding the shroud, I doubt that they will allow further carbon-14 samples and all of that anytime soon. They thrive quite well having the shroud, well, shrouded in a bit of manufactured mystery. Again, they have good tourist money still coming in from the shroud, so why would they get rid of that meal ticket, so to say? And on that bombshell, let's close out this episode. So I hope that we see each other next time too. And until then, feel free to leave a positive review wherever you listen to this, or even better, just tell your friend, recommend them your favorite episode and have them listen to it. That's how we get more listeners and get more visibility. And if you want more information about the podcast, Archaeological Podcast Network, or myself, check out diggingupancientaliens.com. And if you go to the episode page on the website, you will find a full transcript of this episode and all the sources and resources and further reading recommendation that I've used to put all of this together. And if you want to support the show, help out covering some of the bills, head over to patreon.com/diggingupancientaliens. Or if you rather prefer an alternative to Patreon, we have a member portal over at diggingupancientaliens/support. And if you want to support the Archaeological Podcast Network, well, head to their website, archaeologicalpodcastnetwork.com, and you can support the production of more archaeology podcast show over there. And if you want to contact me, you reach me on most social media sites, and of course by email. Just send your, well, corrections or emails in all caps to frederick@diggingupancientaliens.com. Sandra Mertelor created the intro music, and our outro is by the band called Trallskruv, who sings their song Foliehatt. Links to these artists is down in the show notes. Until next time, keep shoveling that science.
Men jag skyddar mig, för jag har foliehatt.
Hello, archaeology lovers, science nerd and history enthusiast. Have you ever dreamt of showcasing your passion for our history and science? Dig no further. Welcome to the official merchandise store for your favorite podcast, Digging Up Ancient Aliens. Embark on a journey through time with our exclusive collection. Wrap yourself in the mysteries of the past with our range of themed shirts, mugs, and apparel. Each piece tells a story about your passions and podcast preference. And for the devoted archaeology aficionados, unveil our latest treasure, the Archaeology Mafia T-shirt. It is more than just apparel. It's a statement, a tribute to those who dig deeper, question the unknown, and unravel the secrets of our ancestors. These are not just merchandise. They are future relics from a time yet to be fully understood. Symbols of your dedication to unveiling the truth behind ancient aliens and the real wonders of our past. Join the crew of Digging Up Ancient Aliens, wear your curiosity, flaunt your knowledge, and join the Archaeology Mafia. Visit our store now and you will get an offer you can't refuse. Let's keep the spirit of exploration alive. Log on to diggingupancientaliens.com/store and grab your piece of history. Remember, the past is always present.